destination set. Planning route. Two. Hackney Down Station. Hackney. London.
You're listening to Community Radio.
KBOO, Portland.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Transpositive is a program that uplifts the voices of transgender and non-binary persons. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Nicolette and I use A and M pronouns.
My name is Frankie and I use they and them.
Welcome, everyone, to Transpositive. Tonight, we're going to be doing trans in the news and talking about some stuff happening that is really important to talk about. And then we're going to get into a conversation with artist Frankie Beilhartz. So let's start with talking about trans in the news. Nicolette, what's going on right now in the news with the transgender community?
Well, the first thing I wanted to start with, this happened very recently, a black trans woman named Aya Raquel, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, was killed in Portland on July 28th. She was stabbed after a prayer vigil for another black person who was shot and killed the day before. Aya was 32 years old, and she was the 15th person murdered in Portland in July, and the 31st black trans woman killed this year, at least as far as we know. Unfortunately, the number could be higher.
Wow, do we have more information about that?
That's all the information I've got right now. I also read that apparently this past month, July, was the most murders we've had in 30 years in 1 month.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was her name? Aya Raquel?
Aya Raquel, at least I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's spelled A-J-A. Yeah, unfortunately, she hasn't been talked about in the media, at least not very much, as far as I know. So,
I brought up TT or Otis. I'm forgetting their last name.
Okay.
But they were also another gender fluid black individual who was killed recently in Portland at I heard about her death, but only through social media. I didn't see any
That's how I found out about her too, was through social media. So that's why that's all the information I have right now.
I'd like to share the story by the Advocate on the murder of Aya Raquel. This is in the Advocate, and it was on August 4th. Police in Portland, Oregon are investigating the fatal stabbing of a black transgender woman last week at a vigil for a shooting victim. Aya Raquel Roan Spears was stabbed to death July 25th at a home in the Northeast Portland area, the Oregonian reports. A vigil had been held nearby for Tyrell Penny, a California man who was fatally shot in the area a few days later. About 20 to 30 people continued the vigil at the home, a fight broke out, resulting in the stabbing of Roan Spears and one other person who survived. Emergency responders attempted life-saving measures on Roan Spears, but she was pronounced dead at the scene. The Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office ruled her death a homicide, the 15th in the state in July. It was also the 25th homicide of a transgender person this year, with most of the victims being Black or Latinx women. News reports gave varying ages for Roan Spears, but the police department says she was 34 years old. Friends, family, and activists are mourning her death. I, along with HRC and so many others, are mourning the loss of Aya Raquel Roan Spears, who was not even able to attend a vigil to mourn without risk of death, says Tori Cooper, the Human Rights Campaign Director of Community Engagement for its Transgender Justice Initiative. Our community needs allies. This violence cannot continue. And we must all ask ourselves why our nation is allowing this epidemic of violence to continue. The Portland police said anyone who has information about the incident and has not yet contacted investigators should contact Detective Brad Clifton at 503-823-0696. So that's the story of Aya Raquel Roan Spears. Yeah, I remember hearing about that. That's just really tragic.
It is.
And then the story of T.T. Gulley. The Human Rights Campaign was shocked, saddened, and horrified to learn of the death of T.T. Gulley, someone who is known as T.T., a 31-year-old Black transgender woman killed in Portland in May of 2019. Her death is believed to have been the 27th known violent death of a transgender or gender nonconforming person in 2019. While she was killed last year, Gulley's death was originally ruled a suicide, but Portland police have since opened an investigation into her death after the victim's family collected and presented evidence that there may have been foul play involved. Black Americans are being lynched in America, said Tori Cooper, HRC Director of Community Engagement for the Transgender Justice Initiative. The details of T.T. Gulley's death must be thoroughly investigated and handled with the utmost care. It is disgusting that local authorities were so quick to rule this case a suicide, forcing a grieving family to do their own work to convince police to care about Black transgendered women who are experiencing homelessness. Black transgender lives matter. We must do more to end this epidemic of violence that is killing more and more beautiful lives. To every Black transgender person reading this, you matter, you have value, and you make the world a better place. These disgusting crimes are terrifying, but never believe that your existence is less than any other person. So that's about T.T. Gulley. We actually would like to do a show about the death of T.T. Gulley. We want to dedicate an entire hour to her. And I guess I think we'll see if we can also do a show about Aya now, that we know this.
So. Yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing those to us, to our attention, Nicolette and Frankie.
Well, thank you for discussing them.
You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio, and we talk about transgender and non-binary issues every other week here on the Queer Programming Blog. Tonight we have the artist Frankie Beilharts with us, and we're going to talk to Frankie about issues related to their art and gender and kind of see where the conversation goes. Frankie, welcome to Transpositive.
Thank you for having me.
Frankie, can you tell us a little bit about your history as an artist? What kind of work do you do? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I grew up in rural Texas, right outside of Austin. And I think that just like really defined my experience as a queer person. Just growing up in a space that was very weird because it wasn't very like, not as explicitly homophobic or transphobic as the rest of Texas, but there is still just these subtle ways that it just wasn't talked about. And even like, the existence of other genders was not mentioned at all. So I think that really informs a lot of who I am and a lot of the art I make. And then I got into painting with a family friend when I was growing up. And then have really just like expanded from there, working in some ceramics and then installation and some sculpture and some like videography. And I really like each project, I take it as an opportunity to like to learn something new and to push myself to create the subjective experience that's in my head.
And you had a show recently. Can you talk about that show?
So Ariana Jacobs, who's a local Portland artist, she also is a professor at PSU, I believe. And then Mac Farland, I believe is his last name, who's a professor at PNCA, held this show in their backyard, which they've been thinking about doing for a while, but when COVID hit, it became for them a very necessary thing to do to continue the gathering of people and continue the exploration of ideas as a community within this time when we are all more separated than we would like to be. And I showed my piece, Dividual, in it.
And I had a chance to see your piece, and it was very interesting because it was these forms, kind of, I guess that you hand stitched, hanging mm-hmm. from a tree, like all of the kind of almost like they were just fruit or something, like different at different levels, and it just had this really wonderful feel to it. It was very organic. What was that piece about?
Oh, that piece had like so many different iterations of meaning to it. I feel like whenever I make something, I'm making something that like I'm trying to understand what I'm even trying to express. And then like as I make it, and there's like this feedback loop that comes back to me through the making of work. And that piece turned out to be for me about the idea of a collective body, kind of all of us on this planet right now, and how we're kind of in the time of COVID becoming more aware of how we all influence each other and all make up this collective body on the earth, and we can't necessarily separate one. The individual exists, but only to a certain extent, I guess. And it exists within this greater individual.
Mm-hmm.
And the fruit themselves, originally I started thinking of them as like the reforming of bodies that have been used, and trying to explore that, to explore my own relationship with my own body. I felt there was something important about the act of eating each one of the oranges and then taking the remnants and stitching them back together.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. So you actually, did you eat 600 oranges?
Like, I guess I keep calling them oranges, but they're tangerines, so they're a lot smaller. and yes.
Oh my goodness.
My roommate helped, so. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's like each one, the peeling of it, the kind of deconstructing, the eating, and then the reconstructing of that body. I was interested in the way that the tangerines look like breasts.
Okay. When you these tangerines, you ate them, and then did you like fill them with something, like some kind of stuffing or something, or just stitch them back together dry?
I didn't fill them with anything. I just stitched them back together. Some of them would dry out and then those would be more deformed, and some of them I would do right away and those would like go back together very almost like a puzzle piece and be almost look like nothing had ever happened. But then as they would dry on my windowsill, they would shrivel up and kind of pull apart and Yeah, I was also interested in like the way that the tangerines decayed over time, because as you saw, some of them were dipped in paint, and some of them were not. And so the ones that were dipped in paint, in a way that they were preserved and they were protected from these elements, in a way that the ones that didn't have that protection, when they were sitting outside.
So you stitched, you I think before the interview started, you told me you made about 600 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But at the exhibit, which was it was part of a series of backyard installation projects that I think they're doing because it's COVID and they can't do many gallery exhibits right now. Most of the art world is shuttered. They did these backyard installations that you could visit by appointment only. And the shows were really interesting. I mean, we had Sean Chamberlain on 2 weeks ago talking about their work, which was, I don't know if you saw Sean's work. Sean's identifies as transgender and was doing this piece about embodied avatars. It was the wheelbarrow one. I don't know if you saw that.
I don't think I did.
But your piece was really interesting too. I had a chance to like see it over time too. So like, there was something. What inspired you after you made these forms, these forms, which in some ways remind you of bodies, to then kind of like hang them from trees at different levels, because that like just gave them a whole new kind of definition.
Yeah. So originally, before COVID hit, I was thinking about doing this installation piece where there'd be so many of these hanging in this room and this video of my body being projected upon them. And so that kind of idea got broken up into three different pieces. But I already had this idea that I wanted them to be hanging. I wanted them to be fluid, something that people could walk through and feel them hitting their own body and kind of have that that bringing them into their own body through that experience. And then when COVID hit and the gallery space was no longer an option, I was like, how am I going to realize this? And I already had made so many. Like, I hadn't made all of them, but I had already made a good deal of them. And so I was talking with my professor, Jess Perlitz, and I was trying to figure out what I could do. And the idea of hanging them from a tree came up, and that just, it sounded like something, it just like was something that felt even more right than having it in some sterile gallery setting. And then the more I did it, the more it just became this practice of like the wrapping of the canvas thread around the branch. It was a very meditative process for me.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I see site-specific installation work that incorporates aspects of nature to it, the first artist that I always go back to is Ana Mendieta. Because, you know, Ana Mendieta was a Cuban-American artist who did really amazing site-specific feminist installation projects like back in the 60s. And her work is just so beautiful. So have you ever seen any of it?
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really gorgeous.
Does Ana Mendieta's process at all like factor into like your own consideration when you're approaching a project?
Yeah, she's someone that's like has been brought up to me a few different times. I really like, the thing I think I resonate most with like her process, from what I know of it, is like the performance aspect of it, almost, that isn't actually documented. There is a piece of documentation always, but like there was this performance. We know that there was this performance of the piece, yet like without having access to that, we are only left with this single, normally photograph of her work. And so I think like the process of the act of making being like the artwork, and then what you're seeing is almost just this residue of it. I definitely really relate with that aspect of it, because it is definitely for me the process of making, which I feel is when like the artwork is the most alive.
How does gender factor into your work as an artist? What kind of consideration do you give to the topic of gender?
Well, I feel like art, like I said, for me, it's just like this this way of expressing a subjective experience that, like, I guess the idea of like everyone has their own reality and everyone's just living within their own reality. And so I guess for me, art is a way of trying to kind of express my own reality. And but also in that way, like, while I'm trying to tell somebody else my reality, they're just having their reaction to this external thing. And so I think for me, like, gender plays a really big role in that, because like gender is just such a huge part of my identity, being genderqueer and non-binary. It's just like it's been such a path of like exploration and repression and like dealing, like, you know, uncovering all the different layers and healing it back. And so like when I feel like every piece I do is kind of influenced by either my experience of gender or lack thereof. Does that get at what you're asking about?
Yeah, thank you. Nicolette, how does your experience as an artist influence your sense of gender? I know that we've talked before with you a lot, Nicolette, about your art, your music, your writing. How does the concept of gender factor into your work? And are there things that you're hearing Frankie says that resonate with you?
I mean, in a way. So, I mean, the difference is I'm not a visual artist. I'm a musician and a writer. But, I mean, I do definitely feel a bit of an influence in that a lot of times my music, I feel I'm embracing masculine energies and feminine energies. I'm trying to combine them all together into something that, you know, transcends gender boundaries within music. And I mean, there's also just the obvious fact that, like, I've written songs and poetry and such about my queer identity, about my gender and my sexuality, and about the difficulties that I've faced for being queer and trans. But yeah, I think that's, you know, something that influences all my music and all my writing is just that, you know, music always has some sort of energy to it that can be feminine or masculine or a combination. And I think that's what I always strive for. I don't see a need to be one way or the other, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Does that sense of that fluidity, is that a reflection too of having a non-binary identity, or is that separate from it?
I believe it is a part of it, yeah, because that's definitely something I've noticed throughout my life, is there's, you know, types of music or energy in music that's associated with masculinity and with femininity, and I've always felt the need to embrace both. And I like combining them together because I feel like that embodies who I am. I need to bring my masculine energy and my feminine energy from my gender into my music and into my work. Oh, I was gonna say also, Frankie, I relate a lot to what you were saying about, you know, growing up as a queer person in a very rural area, because that's also the way I was raised. I mean, I grew up in the Northwest my whole life, but where I grew up was very out in the middle of nowhere, out in the woods, and pretty much everyone where I lived was a heavily conservative Christian. So it's like anything LGBT was not discussed at all, and if it was discussed, then, you know, immediately everyone would turn on you and tell you what a horrible person you are for even thinking about that. So I remember at like 5 years old knowing I was non-binary and knowing I was pansexual, but not knowing the words for these things or if there was anyone else like me, you know, And I only even learned the word bisexual from a movie when I was in middle school. Didn't the word non-binary until like 10 years later on the internet.
Right.
But I remember when I came out as bi, at least that's what I called myself at the time, because that was the only word I knew. I just immediately dealt with so much bullying because it was just not acceptable at all where I lived. So I was just, I guess, curious to hear if you had any experiences you wanted to share about coming to terms with your identity or coming out or anything like that.
Yeah, I came out to my family as non-binary a year ago now. But I never came out as gay. They kind of just all knew. And my family, my close family, the ones I talk to, are all very accepting. So in a way, like, I feel very grateful for that and almost like silly for how much fear I had. But then I go back to those memories and I'm like, oh no, there was, I don't know, it also, like, it just seemed like everyone knew before I even knew. Like, I would get bullied about being a lesbian and stuff. Like, it was, like, whenever I would hang out with a group of girls, it was just, you know, there was just all these, like, homophobic comments going around all the time. And, like, when you're in a locker room, like, there was normally one girl that people would pick out to be like, oh, she's lesbian, she's staring at everyone, like, gross, like... Mm. Even if she may have just been portraying like more queer vibes, it was just like immediately there was this like, oh, this person's a predator attitude. And I remember I had really bad dysphoria about my chest. But I, of course, didn't know what that was then. And I was just like, this must just be puberty. and I would take my mother's, like, ace bandage for wrapping ankles that she had in her medicine cabinet. And I would take it to my room, and I would, like, try and bind my chest down with it. And of course, since it was an ankle bandage, it really didn't work at all. I have this like distinct memory of someone knocking on the door when I had bound myself and just freaking out because I was just so scared that I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew something was wrong. And that was just the vibe I got the whole time, even though, yeah, it was just like, oh no, I definitely had a lot of internalized homophobia, and I honestly still do. I'm still working through it, and I feel like it's just a process that's going to keep on going. It's just like each layer I pull back, there's another one under there in a different way. And it's just like, I don't know, but being able to see my own gender, or like not, that I didn't have to like be confined to the gender stereotypes of woman or man or anything, like being able to actually start exploring gender as a concept was like the thing that I feel like was the most life-saving for me. Yeah, and I guess kind of a question back at you, Nicolette, is like, for me, I feel like I, growing up, I had these very distinct ideas of masculinity and femininity that were constructed by mass society. And then like, as I started questioning gender, I realized that the things that I thought were, the things that I thought were masculine about me and that I was ashamed of were actually like my more feminine traits, like my strength and my ferocity. And then like the things that I thought were like my most feminine traits, my like flamboyance, like I more associate with my masculinity now. And like I've kind of like reconstructed them for myself, but now I'm at a point where I'm like, I don't know, just like questioning the ideas of masculinity and femininity. And I was wondering, because I know you brought that up, and I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your journey on that. And Emma also, if you have things
sure.
to say.
Yeah. And I think that is a good point to bring up, is that, you know, everything that we consider to be masculine and feminine is all really just a social construct. So we can also reconstruct these ideas to mean what we want them to mean, you know? So that's a good point. Like, why can't women be strong and fierce? That can absolutely be a feminine trait. And I think that's really cool that you bring that up. I guess for me, you know, because I grew up in this conservative rural area where everyone was kind of thrust into these very specific gender roles. Girls had to be what was considered traditionally feminine. Boys had to be what was considered traditionally masculine. And I was kind of forced by my parents and by everyone around me to act like a very feminine, girly girl. And I remember at a very young age thinking, this doesn't feel like me. I don't feel like a girl. I don't feel completely feminine, although there are definitely feminine sides to me and feminine aspects of me. I just also felt very masculine at the same time. And I mean, I knew deep down that trying to classify me as a boy or girl just didn't make sense to me. I felt that I was a bit of both, a bit of something in between. And so I guess that sort of stayed with me throughout my life, to the point that, you know, I started expressing very masculine traits somewhat early on, and would get put down a lot for that. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of went back and forth on trying to conform to this feminine girl that everyone expected me to be, while still trying to express my masculinity as well, and trying to avoid the backlash from that. I mean, I don't know if that answers your question or if.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an open question.
Yeah.
It's just, what is this?
For me, It's hard to say to really understand this in language. The kind of indoctrination that you get put in when you're assigned male at birth regarding masculinity is a very specific kind of indoctrination. You're taught that traits that are considered feminine culturally are beneath you. And if you express any of those, you're faced with the threat of violence from other boys. So from a very young age, boys are still taught, people who are assigned male at birth, in many parts of the country, and in my experience, are taught that femininity is weakness and is less of less value than masculinity. People who are assigned male at birth are taught that masculinity involves violence and threat and control, and using the tools available to you to manipulate other people into a perspective of submissiveness in relationship to you. And that's what masculinity is. It's very distorted. It's impossible to live with. And especially for someone who identifies as transgender, it's very challenging. I don't know that I assign a specific sense of what I think. Like, for instance, you said fierceness. I mean, I definitely consider fierceness a feminine trait, and I love that trait. Mm-hmm. And flamboyance, I can definitely see that as a masculine trait as well. I mean, I can definitely see that. It's a really long answer. I don't think I have enough time to answer here, but those are just my initial thoughts.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what you were talking about ties in a lot to this huge problem we have in society with toxic masculinity, this idea that because anything feminine is bad and anything considered soft, emotional, loving is considered feminine and therefore bad. We have this idea that men and even people who aren't men are supposed to be very tough and unemotional and sometimes even cruel and mean and abusive. That's why we have this ongoing problem. And I do think that, you know, really, there's a lot of inherent strength and fierceness involved with being a woman or being non-binary, because we have to fight so hard against the patriarchy to come to where we are now and where we will be in the future, to overcome toxic masculinity and everything else in our way, telling us that who we are is bad and less and wrong. And I was going to say something else, and now I'm trying to remember. Oh, okay. So this is also, I think, why feminism, it benefits more than just women. It benefits non-binary people, and it benefits men, really, because feminism is all about advancing femininity and advancing this idea that there's nothing wrong with being feminine, there's nothing wrong with feminine traits. With that comes the dismantling of toxic masculinity, and that does benefit men. That lets men know that it's okay to cry, it's okay to feel, it's okay to love, it's okay to be soft, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, I guess I feel like as someone who produces queer media, like one of my goals is to undo basically like 4,000 years of patriarchy. I mean, I feel like if anything else, like my own role as a transgender woman in the world is like in my own way as someone who is assigned male at birth and rejected it and really embraced my feminine side, that like I'm like one small person in like a larger movement to try to undo patriarchy, because patriarchy is the enemy. It's the thing that has created so much social dysfunction over the last 4,000 years. And it's been responsible for warfare and for nationhood and for white supremacy and for these intertwining systems of oppression, which really just have really destroyed our potential as a species, as people, as animals, as lovers. And I really feel like patriarchy is really the enemy. And one of my goals in life is to deconstruct it.
Exactly. I feel the same way.
I think, Emma, you just touched on something really important, like that it does, and both of you, I think, did, like that, like feminism really is like the dismantlement of so many different systems of oppression. Like, you can't really have true feminism without the dismantlement of white supremacy. And I just think that this time in history is really important, and I'm glad to be at this stage of feminism. Not necessarily so much feminism in the past, like it's done great things, but like I feel like we're finally starting to realize the intersectionality of it all, instead of it just being for one group of women.
Right, exactly. And that's why intersectional feminism in particular is so important, because misogyny does have inherent intersection with racism, with homophobia, with transphobia, with classism and ableism. Pretty much any type of oppression you can think of, it all intersects with misogyny. And so I think, you know, the only way to be a true feminist is to fight for not just gender equality, but all equality, really, all types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also like, until people like Aya and people like Titi aren't being murdered, like, then we really haven't achieved our goals. And like, we need to keep fighting.
Exactly. And we need to say right now, it's important to say,
Black lives matter, trans lives matter, Black trans mm-hmm. lives matter.
It's so important.
This has been a great conversation. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland. This is part of the queer programming block here in KBOO, and we're talking with artist Frankie Beilharts and with Nicolette, our regular co-host. We're talking about Frankie's work as well as larger issues around gender and identity. We have about 15 minutes left. Frankie, I wanted to make sure that we have a chance to give you and your work a little bit more time if you would like to talk about anything else regarding your work or your process, or if you have upcoming work. I just want to make sure that we give some time to it.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Or is there anything specifically you'd want to hear about?
Well, maybe could you tell us a little bit about how you, like, how you came to be the kind of artist that you are now? What led you to the kind of process that you do? It sounds like you do a lot of work. You mostly classify yourself as a painter, but you also do kind of a range of work, including installation and sculpture. How did you come to your choices as an artist that, like, you know, you find satisfying in your process?
I think actually painting has become more of a personal process, but it's not something I necessarily feel best articulates the things I'm trying to say anymore. I've been much more interested in video, doing performance pieces, and videotaping them. I did this one piece. It was the video that was going to be shown on all of the tangerines dipped in white paint. But I went out to Mount St. Helens when there was still snow up there, and covered my body in beet juice and kind of painted the snow, this white canvas. So I think painting has, like, influenced so much of how I approach the pieces that I make, but I no longer feel that, like, traditional paints are the thing that helps me most express. And then also something I've been getting into more now is making clothes. I mean, I have been for a while, but recently I've been more serious about it. But more textile arts. That's an interesting area for me because it was, my mother taught me how to sew, but also my grandmother on my dad's side. And I don't talk to her much anymore. She's a very opinionated person, and I don't agree with a lot of her opinions. And is someone that I, growing up, felt like I knew that she wouldn't have this power and my parents wouldn't let her, but if I had come out to her, I feel like I would have been put in a conversion camp. So that's it's an interesting thing of having these memories of her sewing and sitting by her and learning how to sew from her and then bringing that into my work now, especially making clothes that I feel like are non-binary or gender non-conforming.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that is a great way to incorporate your identity into your work.
Thank you.
That's so interesting. I mean, to take, it's like you took a story that, like, I normally hear all the time about, you know, learning the value of a skill from, you know, a matriarch figure, but turning it into a different kind of meaning. You know, mm-hmm. I guess in a way you still got a lesson from it, I mean, you still took the value of that information, but like transformed it in a way. I mean, I wonder, it's so, your story is so interesting because it makes me think about how we as queer people take stories from families of origin and repurpose them, you know, mm-hmm. because that's kind of what I hear you saying. I don't know if I'm reading that right, but that's what I'm hearing you say, is that you took an experience from a family of origin and you gave it a different kind of meaning. So yeah. there was still a connection with those stories that I think that we all have, because unfortunately many of us are born into families and are shaped by families, whether we want to be or not. It kind of happens against our will. But it sounds like you took that experience and like remade it into something that you found more meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, it's been a really great experience, and yeah, it's almost like reclaiming it, because it was a sore spot for a really long time, partially because of my grandma, and then partially just because sewing is so, like, it's such a female craft, like not even art, it's a craft, because it is feminine. And then now I've been working with leather and waxed thread, which I feel like has this more masculine connotation to those materials. And then like the process that feels so maternal, I guess, or like I'm the matriarch of like a household, like mending things. And mending my own clothes. And also like goes back to where we are kind of in the world right now with not being able to go get clothes. And then also just like with climate change and how much like we just need to start repurposing what we have. We need to stop just going out and consuming. It's just, we have so many resources right under our fingertips.
That is very true. And I'm glad you bring that up.
You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left in the show. We're talking with artist Frankie Bilharts, who had a show recently. It was part of a backyard installation series held because of COVID-19 and the lack of access to gallery space. And Frankie, what was the name of the piece that you had at that? What was the name of that piece?
It was called The Vigil.
The Vigil?
Individual, like individual, but without the in. Because then it is divisible.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you mentioned near the beginning of the show that you were trying to talk about the interconnectedness of all life.
Yeah, of pretty much like humanity as a body itself, and how we all are interconnected despite the recognize states that have these imaginary borders, we're still all affected by this virus. And yeah, it's, we can't continue to make decisions just for the individual anymore. It's not just about the individual, it is about us all, and we need to make actions accordingly and to be compassionate for those who are in more vulnerable states.
Thank you. I think that that's a powerful thing that a lot of people need to hear right now.
Yeah. I also, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to bring up with our conversation of living in more rural areas and growing up queer in more rural areas. Mm-hmm. I've definitely felt a lot since then being like, oh, like you're overreacting and stuff. But then it's interesting to remember that the Texas versus Florence case was only 2003.
Yeah,
right. It's not only 17 years ago.
Yeah.
That's only 17 years ago. That is like, that was, well, you know, like I'm older than that.
Yeah.
That was a sodomy case mm-hmm. that was tried in 2003, and I think it went all the way to the Supreme Court.
It did. Well, what happened was, I think he was charged for having sex in his own home.
Yes,
in his own home. Took him and found him guilty of sodomy. Mm-hmm. And then he spent like a few years in jail until he brought it to the Supreme Court and was like, this is not okay, because the Supreme Court had already, or I guess they hadn't ruled yet, but a lot of states didn't still have anti-sodomy laws. And there are still states today who like preach anti-gay rhetoric and are required to say anti-gay rhetoric in schools. And I think it's Alabama that even still has it that is supposed to be taught that being gay is criminalized.
Yeah,
but it actually is still criminalized in that state. They just can't enforce it because of the Supreme Court's ruling.
Mm. Yeah, and it's not even just like a state-by-state thing, because like I said, where I grew up, even though it was in Washington, it was in this rural area that to mm-hmm. this is still so homophobic that they've banned any mention of LGBT issues from the public schools there. They've banned any sort of sex education. Like, this is how conservative this area is. And this is in the Northwest, you know, and it's, I guess, disturbing to me that in this day and age, all over this country, we still have so much suppression of queer and trans people, of anything LGBT plus.
Well, it's ridiculous because we need that education. We need sexual health education. And I mean, everyone does. Our sexual health education system is broke. It's so broken. But specifically for gay individuals, and like, there's nothing out there. And the things like what you were saying, like that you learned about being bisexual from a TV show, like, yeah, we're getting our information from media. We're not able to protect ourselves. And like, yeah, we're in a pandemic right now, but what about the AIDS crisis? Mm-hmm. You know, like we need that education, and that is something that is not given to us, and it's not okay that the government, there's people actively taking that away, not just passively, actively taking that away and preventing us from getting the education that we need and deserve.
Yeah, it becomes a public health issue at that point too, because people are having unplanned pregnancies and STDs because they just were never given the sexual education to know how to have safe sex and how to protect themselves.
Exactly.
So Emma, how much time do we have?
We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay. So I guess the first thing we should ask is, Frankie, how can people get a hold of you and find your work if they're interested?
I have a website.
Oh, great.
FrancescaBeilharz.com. And then you can also email me at FrancescaBeilharz@gmail.com.
And Francesca, that's pretty, I think most people would know how to spell that, but Beilharz, can you spell that?
I'll just spell both of them because most people ask me to spell both. Okay. So Francesca, FranCesca, and then Beilharz, BeilHarz, as in zebra.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to say before we close the show?
Me?
Yes, or Emma, or either of you. I don't know.
I think I got everything in that I wanted to say. Thank you for having me.
Well, yeah, thank you for being here. It was really interesting to hear your story and hear about your work. And I think we had such a great discussion about many different topics.
Yeah, I had fun. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yeah. And thank you.
Thanks so much, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Have a good night, everyone.
Have a good night. Bye.
Okay, I'm stopping recording.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.
Los CDC están trabajando para ayudar a mantenerlos a usted y a su comunidad a salvo de la amenaza del nuevo coronavirus. Tome las siguientes medidas cotidianas para ayudar a evitar la propagación de todos los virus. Lávese las manos frecuentemente con agua y jabón por al menos 20 segundos. Cúbrase la nariz y la boca al toser o estornudar con un pañuelo desechable. Luego bote el pañuelo y lávese las manos. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Limpie y desinfecte los objetos o las superficies que se tocan frecuentemente, como los controles remotos y las manijas de las puertas. Evite el contacto cercano con personas enfermas. Quédese en casa si está enfermo. Llame a su médico si presenta fiebre, tos o dificultad para respirar. Para obtener más consejos, visite cdc.gov/spanish.
Thank you. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO.